From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
There's no help, no hospital, no electricity, nothing. No food, no fall, no food, no water, nothing. There's too many people dying.
It's been 1 year since the earthquake. Haiti is still in pain. More than a quarter of a million people died in the quake. More than a million people are still homeless. Cholera has spread, killing more than 3,600 people, infecting more than 170,000. Less than 10% of the $9 billion pledged by foreign donors has been delivered. Today, on this anniversary of the catastrophe, we spend the hour on Haiti with four Haitians, a scholar, a novelist, an activist, and a writer. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Obama is headed to Arizona today to lead a memorial service for victims of Saturday's shooting attack that left Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords critically wounded, six people dead and 13 others injured. Doctors say they expect Giffords to survive the attack, but the extent of her recovery remains unknown. The chief neurosurgeon at Tucson's University Medical Center, Michael LaMole, assessed Giffords' progress so far.
She's going to take her recovery at her own pace, and I'm very encouraged by the fact that she has done so well. This kind of injury, I think we've said it a couple times, a penetrating injury through the skull, really, the survival, let alone recovery, is abysmal. She has no right to look this good, and she does. We're hopeful. But I do want to underscore the seriousness of this injury and the fact that we all have to be extremely patient.
The parents of the suspect, Jared Lee Loeffner, meanwhile, have issued their first public comments since the attack. A written statement attributed to the Loeffner family said, quote, "It may not make any difference, but we wish that we could change the heinous events of Saturday. There are no words that can possibly express how we feel. We wish that there were so we could make you feel better. We don't understand why this happened," they wrote. Earlier in the day, a neighbor of the Loeffners, Wayne Smith, said the family is devastated by the attack.
And they're hurting bad. She's really bad. We may have to put her in the hospital. It's a sad thing. And he told me to tell you guys that when he gets to where he can, he will give you a statement himself. And he will notify you and let you know where it's going to be. It won't be here.
You were saying that they have lost as well here.
Yes, it's a sad thing. Their son did this, not Amy and Randy. And people need to understand that.
The memorial service with President Obama is one of a number taking place in Arizona and around the country. The youngest victim was 9-year-old Christina Taylor Green, a third grader recently elected to the student council at her elementary school. The husband of Susan Hallman, a family friend who escorted Christina to the event and was herself wounded in the shooting, said his wife remains in shock.
I hear her in her semi-conscious ramblings, screaming out, "Christina, Christina, let's get out of here, let's get out of here." And she keeps talking about the holding of hands and then the realization that she was on the ground and the bleeding was profuse. Her memory seems to end there.
Meanwhile, in Haiti, Haitians have begun 2 days of commemoration of the massive earthquake that devastated the country a year ago today. Up to a quarter of a million people were killed, over 1.5 million were made homeless in one of the worst natural disasters in history. On the eve of the anniversary, Haitian President René Préval presided over a ceremony at the Titien mass grave for earthquake victims on the outskirts of the capital, Port-au-Prince.
We must respect the duty of commemorating the dead. It's a duty we must not forget, because it motivates and gives strength to the generations to come, so that they don't suffer what we suffered.
Ahead of the anniversary, the British charity Oxfam released a report slamming the reconstruction effort and the recovery commission headed by former U.S. President Bill Clinton. Oxfam says less than 5% of the rubble has been cleared, only 15% of the temporary housing that's needed has been built, and relatively few permanent water and sanitation facilities have been constructed. We'll spend the rest of the hour on Haiti after headlines. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is vowing to speed the release of classified U.S. diplomatic cables as he fights extradition to Sweden for questioning about alleged sex crimes. On Tuesday, Assange spoke out after a London court set his extradition hearing for next month.
Our work with WikiLeaks continues unabated, and we are stepping up our publishing for matters related to Cablegate and other materials. Those will shortly be occurring through our newspaper partners around the world, big and small newspapers, and some human rights organizations.
A draft version of Julian Assange's defense released by his attorneys warns he should not be extradited to Sweden because he could wind up being sent to the United States to face the death penalty or torture. The White House panel investigating the Gulf of Mexico oil spill has called for a major overhaul of the regulation and oversight of the oil and gas industry in the United States. In its final report, the Presidential Oil Spill Commission called for establishing an independent safety energy within the Interior Department, tougher fines and regulation, and an industry-run safety organization. Commission co-chair Bob Graham unveiled the report in Washington.
A fundamental finding of our 6 months investigation is that the Deepwater Horizon disaster did not have to happen. It was both foreseeable and preventable. That fact alone makes the loss of the 11 lives, the serious injury to others on the rig, and the enormous damage that the explosion caused even more tragic. We recommend, therefore, that Congress and the administration create an independent safety agency within the Department of Interior with enforcement authority to oversee all aspects of offshore drilling safety.
In a statement, the environmental group Greenpeace said, quote, the oil industry will resist the recommendations of the commission at its own peril. The administration will do right by taking swift action to stop risky offshore oil drilling in the Alaskan Arctic and work with Congress to redouble regulation of existing drilling rigs in the Gulf of Mexico and spill response apparatus nationwide. Illinois is poised to become the first state to abolish the death penalty since 2009. On Tuesday, the Illinois State Senate approved a ban on capital punishment following a House vote late last week. Governor Pat Quinn hasn't yet signaled his full support for the measure, but supporters say they expect him to sign it into law. Executions have been halted in Illinois since a January 2000 moratorium that followed revelations of the innocence of at least 20 death row prisoners. A new Afghan government study shows U.S.-led military operations have caused more than $100 million in damages to homes and fruit crops in southern Kandahar province. Tens of thousands of troops have launched a series of offensives in Kandahar over the past year. In a statement, Afghan presidential adviser Mohammad Sadiq called the so-called Hope military operation, quote, has inflicted severe damage to the people. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has paid a surprise visit to Yemen as part of a Middle East tour. On Tuesday, Clinton met with President Ali Abdullah Saleh at the presidential palace in the capital, Sana'a.
We face a common threat posed by the terrorists and al-Qaeda, but our partnership goes beyond counterterrorism. We are focused not just on short-term threats, but long-term challenges. Yemen has announced a number of reforms that we in the international community look forward to supporting in the economic, social, and political sectors.
The meeting follows the recent disclosure by WikiLeaks that Washington and Saleh's government have agreed to cover up the use of U.S. warplanes to bomb Yemen. Clinton's the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit Yemen in two decades. And anti-torture activists rallied in Washington, D.C. Tuesday to mark the ninth anniversary of the opening of the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The protest was led by 173 people wearing hoods and jumpsuits to represent the 173 men still imprisoned at Guantanamo. After gathering outside the White House, the protesters marched to the Justice Department, where they held a blockade. Protests were also held in a number of cities, including Chicago, where 10 people were arrested outside the federal building. The group Witness Against Torture organized the actions to kick off an 11-day liquid-only fast by over 100 members nationwide. 2 years ago next week, President Obama signed an executive order promising to close Guantanamo within a year. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 1 year ago today, Haiti was devastated by a massive earthquake. Up to a quarter of a million people were killed. Over 1.5 million were made homeless. It was one of the worst natural disasters in history. Today, on this first anniversary of the disaster, we spend the hour on Haiti. We begin by going back to January 12, 2010, and to the aftermath of the earthquake, what Haitians call terre tremblée, the earth trembles. Haiti. It's been devastated by a massive 7.0 magnitude earthquake, causing a catastrophe of major proportions.
We need help. We need help, international help. There's no help, no hospital, no electricity, nothing. No food, no phone, no food, no water, nothing. There's too many people dying.
It's really eerie is the sound of just screaming, which is constant. I can hear it right now.
I imagine that not since the Crimean War have surgeons seen and amputated so many limbs, perhaps the Civil War in the United States. But we're talking about a situation that I've certainly never seen in my experience.
Haiti is shaken to the core. It is devastated, as if a bomb, many bombs exploded. The smell of death hangs in the air, everywhere. We talked to a young man who was there digging through cement. He's covered in dust, in cement dust. And we asked him, what are you digging for? And he said, my grandfather.
Vous avez vu les images.
You have seen the images. You know the figures. More than 200,000 bodies were collected on the streets. Counting those still found under the rubble, the dead toll could rise to 300,000. More than 250,000 destroyed or damaged homes. More than 1.5 million people are suddenly homeless.
It is one of the largest, most serious natural disasters in recent decades.
And in combination with a country which is very poor, with a very poor infrastructure, it creates a situation even worse.
The second third of the population has moved into streets, public places, public square, in any available land. And they are right now the non-sheltered people.
No food, no dress, no nothing. They don't have nothing to eat. They don't have nothing to drink.
I can simply tell you that the people of Haiti are in need of more, more, and more to complete the sole task of reconstruction.
So we've come to the end of the hospital compound. It's the morgue. Until the last days, the bodies were piled here, 4 feet deep. Now they say they've taken all the bodies, not exactly clear where, but people are talking about mass graves.
What we've been doing thus far is in a crisis reaction, obviously, to the situation, pushing out as much as we can to address the immediate needs. And it takes an estimated 1 million rations a day in order to sustain it.
This aid attention is nice. The extra supplies are nice. The energy and the money is helpful. But if the Haitian institutions are not rebuilt, nothing will be durable, and in 1 year we'll be exactly where we are right now, which is in pain.
And And 1 year later, the words of Dr. Evan Lyon, a professor with Partners in Health, are agonizingly true. Haiti is still in pain. If anything, the situation has gotten worse. A cholera epidemic has spread throughout the country, killing more than 3,600 people, infecting more than 170,000. More than 1 million people remain homeless, still living in makeshift shelters and hundreds of tent camps. Port-au-Prince is a city of earthquake refugees. There is little food, clean water, or sanitation. Reconstruction efforts have barely begun a full 12 months after the disaster. By some estimates, less than 5% of the rubble has been cleared, and only 15% of the temporary housing that is needed has been built. Less than 10% of the $9 billion pledged by foreign donors has been delivered. Meanwhile, Haitian women and girls are facing an increasing threat of sexual violence. Amnesty International says more than 250 cases of rape in several makeshift camps were reported in the first 150 days after the earthquake. This all comes amidst continuing political uncertainty following the disputed presidential elections last November. The vote was widely denounced as flawed, with reports of fraud and intimidation at polling stations, and protests broke out when the provisional results were announced in December. On Monday, it was reported the Organization of American States will recommend that Jude Celestin, the governing party candidate, should be dropped from the runoff vote. Today, we spend the hour on Haiti. We'll speak with four Haitians. We begin by going to Alex Dupuy. He's a Haitian-American professor at Wesleyan University. He is joining us from Middletown. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Dupuy. Your reflections on this first anniversary of this catastrophe of epic proportions.
Me on your program. You summarized the situation quite well. Most of the the money that was pledged has not been delivered. Of the money that has been delivered, very little of it has been spent. Most of the rubble around the capital city and in the capital city has not been removed. Other than some arteries that lead into the city, and reconstruction, as envisioned by both the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission and the Haitian government, has not begun. Most of the homeless, those displaced by the earthquake, are still living in shelters, though the number has dropped to less than 1 million from the latest figures that I've seen. It seems to be around 800,000, but it's not clear under what conditions those who have left the camps are still living. Electricity is still in short supply. Water is not available to most citizens of the city, and especially in the camps where they're being delivered by aid organizations. The hospitals have not been rebuilt. Healthcare is not being delivered. And so on. So the condition is pretty much as you've described it, and it's pretty grim a year later. Though, of course, given the extent of the damage, reconstruction would be slow. But at least one would have hoped that more progress would have been achieved at this point.
Professor Dupuy, you wrote a piece in the Washington Post called "Foreign Aid Keeps the Country from Shaping Its Own Future." Explain what you mean. Lay out your argument.
Well, my argument is basically twofold. One needs to distinguish between the humanitarian aid, the massive humanitarian aid that was given to Haiti immediately after the earthquake, and the long-term, the short and long-term reconstruction of Haiti as envisioned by the international community. And by the international community, I mean the major foreign powers, such as the United States, Canada, and France, and the international financial institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, the USAID, and the Inter-American Development Bank. And the problem here, as I see it, is that the strategies that they have that devised for Haiti's reconstruction are no different than the strategies that they have put in place in Haiti for the past three decades or more that have proven to have failed. Those strategies were based on a twofold strategy. One was to transform Haiti into a supplier of the cheapest labor in the region for the garment industry for export, primarily to the United States. And the other was to dismantle all protective tariffs against food imports and other imports into Haiti that resulted in a devastation of Haitian agriculture, to the point where Haiti went from being able to produce up to 80% of its food in the mid-1980s to now importing to producing only 42%. And especially rice production, which is a major staple crop in Haiti, where Haiti used to have self-sufficiency in producing rice, now it's the largest, the fourth largest importer of U.S. rice in the world. And former President Clinton himself admitted in testimony to the Senate Foreign Committee that the strategies that he himself had pushed on Haiti have not worked. They've benefited his farmers in Arkansas, but they were detrimental to Haitian agricultural production, especially rice. Yet these are the same policies that are now being pushed again on Haiti by the Interim Haiti Commission, which he and Prime Minister Jean-Max Bellerive co-chair. But I should point out that within the commission, even though there are equal numbers of Haitians and foreign members on the committee, that the foreign members of the committee call all the shots. And Haitians have, in fact, openly complained that they are being excluded from meetings and from decision-making processes. Moreover, when the commission was being set up and the action plan for the reconstruction of Haiti was being developed, Haitian grassroots organizations, organizations from civil society that represented a cross-section of the Haitian population, were systematically sidelined. They were ignored. Their voices were ignored. And yet they are the ones who have been proposing meaningful alternatives for a more progressive, more just, more equal reconstruction of Haiti. So the point that I was trying to make in the op-ed in the Washington Post was precisely that the objectives of the foreign community, so to speak, the international community, is not so much about Haiti as it is about helping their own firms, their own farmers, their own their own exporters and their own economies, rather than that of Haiti and the Haitian and the needs, meaning the needs of the Haitian people. The other point that I raised in the piece was that Haiti has now been transformed into what has been correctly called the Republic of the NGOs. And this is a strategy that was started about three decades ago, whereby foreign donors would systematically bypass the Haitian state and fund instead non-governmental organizations to provide services to the Haitian population, in effect, rendering the state even weaker than it was before and making it less able to respond to the needs of its citizens. Now, the Haitian state has a long history of neglecting the needs of the majority of Haitians, but rather than working with the Haitian government and compelling it to respond to the needs of its citizens in terms of healthcare, jobs, housing, education, and so on, by bypassing the state and funding NGOs directly, it sapped even further the capacity of the state to face up to its responsibilities and weakening it even further. So the point I was trying to make is that the foreign community has a direct role to play in collaboration with the Haitian elites to create a situation in Haiti where the vast majority of the population continue to live in poverty, and their basic needs and their basic rights are being ignored. That was the point of the article.
I'd like to ask you to stay with us, but when we come back, we're going to go directly to Haiti to speak with Patrick Ely, who we spoke to when we were last in Haiti 6 months ago, a longtime Haitian democracy activist. We're speaking with Wesleyan University professor Alex Dupuy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report on this first anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti. Stay with us.
La traka pou neg la kay. Pase tray an bakay pay. Nan yon peyi pa gen travay. Ya pe ou li yon tren san ray. Tout la jounen neg pa travay. Ti moun yo pa ka l'ekol. bouton ni prêt pour faire fond. La vie m'a dit qui ça pour faire. Des fois me sentir moi ta crier. Oh, des fois me sentir moi ta reler. Des fois me sentir moi ta crier. Bise en la caillou qui n'a misère. Des fois me sentir moi ta crier. Oh, des fois me sentir moi ta reler. Des fois me sentir moi ta crier. Bise en la caillou qui n'a misère.
T. Rosemond, he won the equivalent of the American Idol competition in Haiti. We saw him when we first went to Haiti right after the earthquake. He was traveling with a large family, making his way out of Port-au-Prince, escaping as so many Haitians were trying to do to get away from the terror. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It's the first anniversary of the Terre Tremblée, the Earth Trembles. That's Creole for the earthquake. And we go directly to Port-au-Prince, where we're joined by Patrick Ely, a longtime Haitian democracy activist, Haiti's former Secretary of State for Public Security. He's speaking to us from downtown Port-au-Prince in front of the Champ de Mars, just opposite the National Palace, where thousands of Haitians continue to live in a massive tent camp. It's good to see you again, Patrick Ely. Can you share your reflections on this first anniversary of the earthquake, especially just where you stand, what you're looking out over?
Well, I'm looking at the end of an era, the end of politics for tens of years, if not centuries. And I'm looking at the defeat of that vision. But I'm also looking at the incredible will to live that exists in this country. And to tell you the truth, even though I'm sad today, but I'm not giving up, I'm not discouraged. And I believe the Haitian people will once again surprise the world precisely by its creativity and its will to live that is unshakable even by such a monstrous earthquake.
When we last spoke, we were standing on the rubble of the Montana Hotel, where people were buried underneath. You're standing in front of the Champ de Mars. Thousands of people remain there. I think this is very hard for people outside of Haiti to understand how still a million people are displaced in Haiti. This after the catastrophe of a quarter of a million at least killed, and now you have cholera on top of this. What has happened in this year?
Yes.
Why hasn't aid come, Patrick?
Well, first of all, you know, you were dealing with a country that was in very bad shape to start with. And you were dealing with a state that was weak for the mission it must execute. And the earthquake and, paradoxically, the outpour of solidarity has not made things better in terms of the ability and the will of the state to rise up to the challenge. So, of course, 1 year later, I believe everybody would have expected to see better result, a more pronounced improvement of the situation. But really, what I'm seeing is, if you want, question me, but it's not at all as bad as it is usually described. I don't think truly that the Haitian people have to be pitied or mourned. They have to get true solidarity in their endeavor to rebuild. And not to rebuild the same. You know, Port-au-Prince is a city, and a city is a living organism. And Port-au-Prince, as we speak, is trying to relive the same way it was. And that would be a catastrophe for the country. Port-au-Prince has been strangling the rest of this nation, the rest of this country, for decades. It's time, after the earthquake, to question the whole vision of how Haiti was built. It is time, if you want, to, I don't want to say to destroy Port-au-Prince, but to put it in its right place in this country. We must resist the impulse to rebuild Port-au-Prince the way it was, a city of exclusion, of hyper-concentration, and of shanty towns, which, if you want, contributed very, very much to the high toll that we've paid after the earthquake. So we definitely have to break away from the course we seem to have been taken, which has been to do more of the same. We must do that, otherwise it's going to be worse than before.
Who controls Haiti now? Who is in control of the reconstruction? We were just speaking with Professor Alex Dupuy, who talked about the IHRC, the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission, co-chaired by Bill Clinton and the Haitian Prime Minister, Jean-Max Bellerive.
I believe that at the moment, Haiti is controlled by a foreign government and foreign interests, the so-called international community. And I'm afraid that in the month or maybe years to come, it's going to get even worse because, as you know, the election did not, if you want, mobilize the Haitian people. And whoever gets elected is going to be a very weak government, very weak president, with very little popular legitimacy. So the ability of this new leadership to actually mobilize Haitians for reconstruction and be able to engage the international community on a partner-to-partner basis is going to be very, very small. So it's going to take time. But I do believe that the earthquake is also a signal for us to build Haitian democracy on sound foundations, which means the neighborhood committees, the grassroots organization, and instead of trying to build a democracy from the top down. That's how we built our houses in Port-au-Prince, and you saw what happened. So I believe it's time for serious soul searching for the nation and to do an assessment of what has been the latest episode in Haiti's search and for democracy, which has lasted at least a quarter of a century with very poor results as we speak.
I wanted to bring in Jean Sainville and then get your response, Patrick Ailly. We're turning to Canada. He's in Ottawa, the Haitian writer and activist. His website, GodIsNotWhite.com, on this first anniversary of the earthquake that killed hundreds of thousands of people, now more than 1 million, and the country is only 10 million people, and cholera ravaging through the country. Jean Sainville, your thoughts.
Well, I was listening attentively to Alex Dupuy and Patrick, and they've really covered a lot of my thoughts. And I think one of the things that is common in what they've said is that there's not evidence that we've made that shift. Patrick mentioned that Port-au-Prince is trying to rebuild itself on the same principle that it had built itself before and is has collapsed. The same thing with the way Alex Dupuy described the international community. I think that another Haitian author described it pretty well. Edwidge Dantica, who published in the Miami Herald earlier this week an article titled "Haitians Are Tired, But We Are Not Defeated." I would add that we are sick and tired, but not defeated. As you mentioned, we have lost more than 3,700 Haitians through the cholera brought to Haiti by UN troops. And what we are seeing is, instead of resources being mobilized to deal with protecting human lives, building infrastructures for a new Haiti, instead we're seeing the international community, which includes the United Nations, mobilizing resources to maintain the status quo. So my perspective on this is that 1 year after the earthquake, we are seeing the Haitian population being treated and seen as a threat rather than as an asset. And to me, that's the major paradigm shift that must occur if we have to get out of this mess.
I wanted to ask you, Alex Dupuy, before we go back to Port-au-Prince with Patrick A. Lee, about the U.S. official who was in charge of relief efforts following Haiti's devastating earthquake, who's accused a major contractor of shortchanging him for his assistance in securing more than $20 million in reconstruction deals. It was the Haiti Recovery Group he's suing, and it was Louis Luck that the Associated Press was reporting on.
Well, I don't know all the specifics of that suit, but what is known is that of the contracts that have been given out to by the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission, most of those contracts have gone to U.S. firms. Only two of them went to Haitian firms. And in a significant percentage of the contracts that went to U.S. firms went to two firms, according to news reports, with no-bid contracts. So I'm not sure if this is what the suit is targeting.
Let me ask Jean Sainville, are you familiar with this case?
Yes, I've read the report on the web about this. And if I am not mistaken, Mr. Louis Luck is actually a former U.S. ambassador to Switzerland. And he was working with the USAID in Haiti. And he is suing the Haitian company led by Bijou, the Bijou Group, which actually Bijou is described as the richest man in Haiti, part of the small Haitian elite that controls basically the economic life of Haiti. What's interesting in this article is that it's describing that the work that Louis Luck has done is really lobbying former U.S. presidents Bill Clinton and George Bush for contracts that he was securing for American companies. To me, this is an example of exactly what is wrong with the current model, where non-Haitians have more power than Haitian leaders in Haiti, and the corruption that has been treated in Haiti as if it was a, you know, a genetic disease that only affects the Haitian players. We are seeing that the IHRC, led by Bill Clinton and Jean-Max Bellerive, is actually only led by the international players. People have actually been asking, where is the Haitian Prime Minister, Jean-Max Bellerive? At the last meeting that took place in Dominican Republic, he wasn't even there. And that's where the 12 members of the Haitian participants in this commission were saying that contracts are being signed, major decisions are being made without them being involved. So basically, the Clinton Global Initiative and Bill Clinton himself, not to talk about all the conflict of interest being the husband of the U.S. Secretary of State, I mean, Haiti is not being led by Haitians. And that's basically what's been wrong with the situation since 2004.
Patrick A. Lee, I want to come back to you as you stand there in front of the Champ Mars, where so many people remain in these refugee camps. And I was wondering if you could give us a history lesson for those not familiar with Haiti and its birth out of a slave rebellion, and then what you think needs to happen right now concretely on the ground. As you say, your country is being controlled by foreign interests, by foreign governments.
It is indeed a huge challenge that we're facing as a people, maybe as big as the one we did face successfully in 1804. And as for, if you want, the vultures descending on Haiti, I believe we evoked that the last time we met on the Montana. And the only people that can prevent that are the Haitians themselves, with the help of foreign friends that keep their vigilance high, because, you know, things are going on that are beyond the back of the people of the world that were so generous toward Haiti, and beyond the back of the Haitian people. And really, what's need to be done, it's not easy to map out. To tell you the truth, there's no magic wand. A lot of the people you see out in the Champ de Mars, they were not living any better before in Cité Soleil and in the different shantytowns. The difference is not now. They're making their presence known. They're in your face, so to speak. And I hope that they will be able to show both the world outside and the Haitian elite that things have to change. And in a way, and I measure my words, to see these people in the Champ de Mars, right smack in front of the National Palace, is a positive message. It has to remind anyone who finds itself in this ruin of a building, anyone who's living in a $5 million U.S. dollar mansion, that these are Haitians, and they have to be, if you want, enfranchised, and that their need and their demands have to be met. So, you know, as they say in Haiti, c'est un bien pour un mal. We've exchanged an evil for a message that had to be heard for years and years.
What, at this point, do you feel needs to be done? Do you feel that the IHRC, that is run by President Clinton, former President Clinton, and Belle Reeve, should it continue? Should it be dismantled? You talk about the community organizations that could rise up, a changing of Port-au-Prince, but how will this actually happen?
I do believe that we need something different from the Haitian state as it is and as it will emerge from this election to lead the effort in reconstruction. Obviously, there has to be, pardon me, representative of the donors, but mostly the Haitian representation should reflect more the Haitian community as it is. It's not enough to have big shot lawyers and technicians. The voice of the communities, both of Port-au-Prince, but also in the other parts of the country, which represent our way out of this mess, their voice has to be heard also. And to be frank, I've not heard those voices spoken in the reconstruction. So for me personally, one of the very encouraging things that emerged from the earthquake was the birth or the rebirth of the neighborhood committees. And many of them, I must admit, you know, just organized so that they could profit for the charity. But some of them have remained, and they are, if you want, sketching their way ahead. And the movement has spread away from Port-au-Prince and away from the cities to what we call the LACU, which are the small peasant communities. In my opinion, there lies the future of Haiti and of its democracy, not up in the fancy hotel or the convention centers.
Patrick Elie, I want to thank you for being with us, Haitian democracy activist speaking to us from Port-au-Prince. When we come back from break, we will go to Carrefour to speak with the Haitian writer Edwige Danticat, the Haitian-American novelist. Stay with us. Napchant pour Haïti by Adrian Moffat and Nomadic Massive, submitted by Eric Provencher and CKUT University Radio in Montreal at our Facebook page. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report on this first anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti, the Terre Tremble, the Earth Trembles. We continue with Edwige Danticat. She is the Haitian-American novelist. She is speaking to us from Carrefour, Haiti. Her latest article in The New Yorker is called A Year and a Day. Her latest book, Create Dangerously, The Immigrant Artist at Work. Among her other books are Crick Crack. Edwige, I know that we don't have a great phone line, but we just felt, no matter what, we wanted to speak to you as you return to Haiti. You say Haitians are tired, but they are not defeated. How are you feeling today?
Thank you so much for having me, Amy, and thank you for having this program. I think a lot of people, both here in Haiti and in the Haitian diaspora today, we feel a great deal of sadness because today we remember, you know, so many people that this country lost, so many people lost to us personally. So there's a sense of sadness, the sense of commemoration. Today here is a national holiday. Schools and offices are closed. But there's still, the streets are busy. People are trying to go about their days. And even though there are many religious ceremonies and prayer services planned, small and large, but there's still a sense that because people don't have any choice, you know, they still have to wake up today and go about the daily business of survival.
You begin your piece in the Miami Herald talking about the Greek myth Sisyphus. Can you take it from there?
Well, you know, and the most recent former prime minister of Haiti, Michel Pierre-Louis, and this Miami Herald direct a documentary called New Bouquet, We Are Tired, talks about this myth of Sisyphus, of you know, this Greek myth of someone rolling a rock up a hill and then finding that when you get up the hill, the rocks roll back down again, and it's a repetitive process. But in the most sort of optimistic view of that story is that every time you do it, you think it's the last time. And she, as she aptly says, it's an incredibly apt at this moment metaphor for Haiti and what Haitians are going through. But the, you know, the upside of that is that we've heard so much this year about it, in part, you know, because it's so true. Haitian people are very resilient, but it doesn't mean that they can, you know, suffer more than other people. And I think, and that that's what also one needs to emphasize. A year later, there are 1.5 million people still living in tents. There's these reports of women being raped, and now at this point where some of the settlements are on private land and the owners are becoming tired of people being there and are intimidating them into relocating. So even though, you know, there's still some great symbolic signs that we, for example, the reopening of the open market yesterday, and but there's still a lot of suffering here. A lot of people are suffering. And as we remember the dead today, it's important to remember that too, the sort of the long suffering of the living that will continue past this day into tomorrow, and sad to say, perhaps into next year and the following year. So we have to also remember the suffering of the living, which continues here.
And how cholera is affecting the people there, with some 3,600 people dead of cholera, 170,000 or so infected.
Well, there's been a stall in the conversation about cholera, in part because of the election stalemate here, and as the anniversary is approaching, but it remains a very large problem. And potentially, you know, as the CDC and other organizations have declared, is that cholera can potentially kill more people than the earthquake. And cholera can spread quickly and spread quickly in this country. And it was born out of the circumstances that have been discussed through, you know, whether one believes that it was through these Nepalese soldiers, but it can spread pretty quickly. And it's something also, as we look at potential disasters, including the potential for lack of food security, because we have farmers in the Artibonite who refuse to go into the rice paddies because they're afraid of the bacteria-infected waters there. So there are a host of other issues also looming ahead as we commemorate this day.
I mean, the figures are stunning of how little money has made it to reconstruction in this year of the $9 billion promised. I wanted to play for you a clip of President Clinton. I know he is back in Haiti right now. We were there right after the earthquake, and then Sherif Abdelkaddous and Nicole Salazar and I, along with Kim Ives, went back for the 6th anniversary. It was a ceremony they held, and then President Clinton gave a speech and talked about how important Haiti was to him.
I intend to spend the next 7 weeks, except for the time it takes me to marry my daughter off, making sure the donors who have made these commitments give us a simple schedule. When will they deliver the money? How much and when? When they do, then we will get as much as we can for budget support for the Haiti government. And Prime Minister Bellerive and I will do everything we can to then push these projects through the Reconstruction Commission so the people of Haiti can feel and see them being done.
That was President Clinton in Port-au-Prince, standing in the shadow of the rubble of the palace, which at that point had hardly been touched, right in front of the Champ Mars, where we were speaking to Patrick Elie today, the big plaza where thousands of Haitian refugees still live. Now, less than 10% of the $9 billion pledged by foreign donors has been delivered. It's 6 months after that speech, a year after the earthquake. Patrick A. Lee was just talking about the country being run by foreign interests. Is that your assessment, Edwige Dantecat?
Certainly, a lot of foreign interests here. You know, both I think in the NGO sector and the sort of potential inevitable flood of disaster capitalism that follows situations like this. I think we need to keep reminding not just the donors but other witnesses about this this sort of lack of you know, the pledges have been made, but that these have not been delivered, because often there's this impression that this has happened and it's been consumed by corruption. But I think that's one thing we need to keep reminding other people. The foreign interests, I think, will always be there, but we also have to focus our attention, on the Haitian people, as Patrick was just saying, on Haitian men and women who ultimately will be the ones to rebuild the country. And these donors and the NGOs and even the disaster capitalists must remember that that's who will ultimately build this country, the men and women of this country. And they have the will, and sometimes they're portrayed as sort of passive receivers, and that act is enough. They have the will, they have the ability. All they need now is this opportunity by those both inside Haiti and outside of Haiti who control the purse strings of this country, that they have to remember that these men and women here need to be able and want to and are willing to rebuild their country if they're given the opportunity to do so.
Jean Sainville in Ottawa, your response to President Clinton saying this was his top priority, and also to the election, the Haiti Provisional Electoral Council releasing preliminary results, and saying that that Celestin is out and the runoff will be between the musician Michel Martelly and the former First Lady Merland Manigat, with Lavalas excluded from the election.
Yes, I think, again, in both of these instances, the key word is accountability. If 5 years from now, 10 years from now, President Clinton comes on TV and says, oops, I guess, you know, I did not succeed, what's going to happen? Nothing. President Clinton is not accountable to the people of Haiti. And this is exactly the challenge that Haitians are facing today. We have players who have lots of power, decision-making power, yet zero accountability, making the key decisions about the lives of Haitians, whether it is with regards to the reconstruction money or with the elections. We had a major scandal at the end of the year where Brazilian diplomat Ricardo Setenfos came out and made a couple of interviews where he explained that not only did the international mission in Haiti fail, but that there are illegal things that are being discussed in plain sight. For instance, he mentioned that the day of the election, November 28th, he went into a meeting which involved the head of the UN mission in Haiti, Mr. Edmond Mullet, representatives of the donor countries. He didn't mention who they were. But they were discussing looking for a plane so they can put the current president of Haiti, René Préval, and expel him from the country. I mean, this is grave accusations from the OAS special representatives to Haiti. So I think what needs to happen is that people should play their key role. The UN must be forced to mobilize resources to fight cholera in Haiti. Whether they caused it or not, it is clear that the Nepalese camp in Niobelais was not treating their excrement.
We must leave it there, but we'll continue to follow Haiti, of course. Jean Sainville, Edwige Dantecat, Alex Dupuis, thank you so much.